Okay. Let's get going. How's everybody doing today? How many people weren't sick in the last couple weeks? Wow, you're lucky because it seems like everybody else was sick. Yeah. So, team projects. People are being good about reporting their progress, and may be interesting to hear about what some people are up to. Richie, could you tell us what your team is doing? What your project is and what you've been doing?
We're working on trying to find a better time to flow heat flow meter, which is a device that people with asthma use to measure how to control their asthma in at a certain time, how much volume their lungs are taking in. So right now, we've initially met with the person who took the project, and we started brainstorming a little bit about possible ideas. Like some of the ideas that we're thinking is trying to make it like more of a wow factor for now. Once we find our user, which for now we're thinking about narrowing it down to the target audience, the children or something like that, because children, generally that's what the person who posed the project said, like children will still have asthma and a lot of adults have outgrown it. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to tailor it more towards the children. So we're thinking some ideas like party streamers, like maybe like when you blow into it, there's like sound or like kind of like musical instrument. And so we have like a bunch of wild ideas and we'll narrow it down.
Perfect. That's perfect. Anybody else want to give a short report on their team's activities? I guess not. Okay. Well, please keep me up to date on what you've been doing every week. It's really important for me to know that you're doing stuff, and it's important for you to be active every week. You know, it's not the kind of thing where if you have a project due at the end of the term that you can spend that last week and work on the project, and that's all you need to spend. This is a different kind of project. You need to work on it every week. You need to do something. Otherwise, you're going to be... There's not going to be enough time at the end for you to do what you need to do. Okay, we've seen this before. So, on Thursday, we're going to have a little bit of time at the beginning to have a little bit of a discussion. So, I think I'm going to leave it up to you to make a choice of among these items or suggest something else. So, a lot of these I've done before. I've done a little talk about failure and how it's advantageous in the design development process. It'll only be about 5 minutes or so. So I'll go through all of them, and then you can vote, okay? Famous people with disabilities. I have a list of people, people that are in all walks of life, people at Stanford, people in the movies, people on TV, stuff like that. It's amazing to see how many of them there are. So that's sort of interesting. One thing I haven't done is have this video theater. So there's a lot of articles that I've been sending to you on Friday about things that I found in magazines and stuff like that. And a lot of them have videos, and they're very interesting. So that's an option for Thursday. Fun with ethics. I know people in STS are very interested in ethics. So, not that it's fun, but, you know, you got to add, there's a lot of ethical considerations when you work with people with disabilities. So, I got a few of those that we can discuss. I have a slide set of really old assistive technology, you know, back into the early 1900s. So, you can see what things looked like back then. It's pretty interesting to see how things have progressed. If somebody wants to talk about their project and get help from other students, we can do that as well. So given all those options, or if you have something else in mind that you want me to talk about, make a choice. Let me know what seems interesting to you. Anybody? Julia? Video theater? Okay. I got some great videos. Yeah. Any other votes? Yeah. Vintage one? Okay. How am I going to choose which one to do?
Why don't you write down the number on the comment card?
Okay. Yeah, so make your choice on the evaluation. So, if you don't have one, Margaret will pass one around to you. And everybody is encouraged to fill it out, not just students, but community members as well. I want to hear everybody's input. Okay. So, something new this week, a new sign-up sheet. If your team wants to meet with me, which is always a good idea for me to know who you are and what you're doing and talk to you face-to-face, it can only help your grade unless you threaten me, and I'm sure you're not going to do that. So, so you can sign up here. I have a bunch of times. I think after the midterm, I would like to institute mandatory weekly meetings. These will only be like 15 minutes or so, just to make sure you're on track and doing stuff. So that's what this forum is for. Okay. I want to again point out that Arna has treated us with a lot of professional photos, which I put on the website. So it'd be silly to not view them because you put so much effort into them. So please check those out. Weekly progress reports. If you have anything that you've sketched out or any prototypes, I really want to see them. So I mean, if you want to meet with me, that's fine. If you want to, you know, scan in your sketches or take a picture of your prototypes, that's good as well. You know, the more that I know that about what you're doing, the better it's going to be. Okay. So, I want to point out that Margaret and Pran can help you with your project. They can give you a unique insight on what you're doing. And, you know, you can also talk to other people, other students in the class, and people in your dorm. A lot of times they can help you brainstorm your ideas. And it's really good to have, like, a fresh view from outside your team. So don't be afraid to get other people involved in your brainstorming and review of what you're doing. I mentioned that I have a bunch of links about interacting with and writing about people with disabilities. This will come in handy when you do your reports. The suggestion box is always open. And maybe, you know, I think I'd like to have you view this video on your own because it's sort of long, but it's a great video, a TED Talk by Henry Evans, who's a local resident who has quadriplegia and he can't speak either. But it's amazing how he does his presentation. So I'm not going to spoil it for you, but check that out. You can just search for Robots for Humanity. Let me know when you finish writing, okay? So on Thursday, Terry Adams from the Office of Accessible Education will give a talk. And this year she's going to talk about her issues with a couple of the wheelchairs that she had. You know, people who are wheelchair users, the wheelchairs don't last forever. And typically, you know, 2 or 3 years is the lifetime of wheelchairs. So getting a new wheelchair is a whole process fraught with all sorts of challenges. And she'll be talking about that. So today we're so lucky to have three individuals going to talk about international perspectives. A student, a local employee of Benetech, and our visiting professor from Thailand. So it's going to be really interesting to see what perspectives that they bring. You know, we've been talking about disability in terms of the U.S., so it'll be really enlightening to see these other views as well. So what we're going to do now is take a short break, so anybody that came in late can sign in and get a cookie, and we'll get started again in about 3 minutes.
the group project?
Yes.
I originally went into police work either on my own or with one person.
Yeah.
Just because of, I know how hard scheduling and communication can be with the project.
Yeah.
And then Nick joined our group and it's fine. I'm going with it, but yeah. I'm just a little bit worried because of, like, all the communication and scheduling that I'm worried about not really happening. And I'm just wondering, I feel more confident in my ability to catch up on my project, and I'm wondering if it's really not going to go back to my original plan of just being in the wheelchair on my own.
Dwight is working on the customized the wheelchair as an individual as well, but you know, he has a little bit different schedule issue because you know he plays basketball.
Yeah.
So if that's good for you, you can approach him with that, or you can do it on your own.
Yeah. Well, I know that with that one specifically, it was I was under the impression you're working with a specific client for their
right.
Want. So I guess I was wondering if the availability of people to work with
right.
Because I prefer to just do it on my own. I know.
No, you can.
I know that I can do this.
No, you can be a team of one. That's fine.
It's not too late to switch or anything.
No.
Not very much has happened.
So you haven't had success in talking to Nick?
Well, I was gonna talk to them both about wanting to leave the group today, but neither of them are even here. And like, we had plans to work on them after classes because that was our availability, and it never really happened.
Okay, you have to navigate.
So I'm just wondering if I could.
Well, you know, it's always bad for an individual to leave a team. So so if you think it's unworkable, then you make that decision.
I think that I probably can. I don't think that there will be ill will or feelings or anything.
So there's two other people that you were on the team with?
Yeah, and they're good friends with each other, and I think we'll be
okay. Okay. We'll see.
I just think I can catch up better if I can work on my own
right.
time.
That's right, because you can schedule yourself.
Yeah, and I'm a seamstress, and like I do like crafty things, so I know that like it's not going to be too much for me to handle on my own.
Okay. Do you want to help Dwight a little bit too on his stuff, or do you just?
I prefer to work on my own.
Okay, fine. All right.
I understand
fine.
The collaborative process, but I think I'll get brainstorming and people in my house and stuff like that, and I can do that.
Okay. You can approach people and tell them you will work on your own and let me know how it goes. Okay.
Is there like a list of the email addresses for people who work still like clients for the show, you know, like the department?
There's two places you can go. You can go to the Office of Accessible Education and see if there's a student around who might be able to help you. And then there's another set of source of clients would be veterans.
So finding the hospital. Finding your individual
clients. Right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I can probably do that.
Okay.
I'm pretty good at friends with Morgan Duffy from last year.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be great. Awesome. Thank you so much. It's a huge relief to me.
I've
been worried about the traffic going so slowly.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the issues.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. You can set up here if you want.
Okay.
There you are. Here.
Do I need?
No, it's for recording.
Okay.
For that.
Hi, everyone. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me to speak today. So just a quick introduction about myself. So I'm from Israel. I practiced law in Israel for 3 years before coming to Stanford. I was a clerk at the Israeli Supreme Court for the Chief Justice, and then practiced law in a law firm. And at Stanford, I graduated last year from my master's in the law school. And I've started this year the doctorate program at the law school. So actually, my research focuses on issues of torts and conflict resolution, less related to disability rights. I'll speak to you today a bit about what I know about this topic from my work at the Supreme Court. And my talk will also draw on the work of Sagit Mohr from Haifa University. So what I would like to do today is to briefly describe the process of formation and acknowledgement of the rights of persons with disabilities in Israel. And I will try to show how, despite a lot of positive advancements in this respect, there's still a long way to go, and the legal status of persons with disabilities in Israel is still quite unsound. And I will try to suggest some potential explanations to this gap. So before I begin to dive in sort of to the more, to the topic itself, there is a definition issue that I wanted to see if you know, and otherwise I will talk about it a little bit. So does someone know what the distinction is between social rights and civil rights? Is anyone familiar with that distinction? Okay. So either you don't know or too shy to say. So I will explain briefly. So the basic distinction, without going into too much legal stuff, civil rights usually refer to freedom from any coercion by the government, and the right to participate in all aspects of civil life. So, for example, the right to vote, freedom from coercion by the government in any respect. And it's usually more like negative rights rather than positive rights. So the government shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that. And that's different from social rights, which are usually more socioeconomic related. So, for example, the right to health, the right to housing. So these are more positive rights because it means that the government needs to do something for you, something affirmative, rather than not do. Usually social rights will be more expensive, right? Because if the government has to do something, it has to provide some minimal health, standard of health or housing, then it entails a budget for that. And you'll see throughout my talk why is this distinction important. But I'll start a little bit about telling you a little bit about the situation in Israel. So in recent years, the last couple of decades, there's been a huge transition in Israel with regard to the rights of persons with disabilities. So there's been a huge stream of legislation and case law with regard to this issue, and it was mostly led by NGOs, one NGO in particular that's been very active in this respect. And one of the highlights of this process had been Israel's Equal Rights for Persons with Disabilities Act of 1998, which was a very crucial milestone in this process of the formal legal acknowledgement of the rights of persons with disabilities in Israel. So this act has been a very impressive achievement for protecting the rights of persons with disabilities, and I will tell you a little bit about what it contains. But it was actually a compromise, as happens many times in the political process. The initial bill from 1996 was far, far broader, and the intention was to create this all-encompassing legislation that basically pertains to all rights of persons with disabilities, so including accessibility, employment, education, health, basically anything that any right that that we can think of. And that was endorsed by the government, and it even led to the establishment of a special committee, a public committee that discussed the different aspects, the different rights, and submitted its recommendations to the government. But then, as often happens, the political constraints came into play, and that led to splitting the proposed legislation and passing only the issues that would clearly get support by the Israeli parliament. And just as an anecdote, I will tell you that the Minister of Finance at the time objected even to this more limited legislation. and threatened to resign if it will pass. And he did that eventually in the end of 1998, not only because of this act, but a lot of other issues. So the act finally passed in 1998, and it contained only issues that relate to employment and accessibility. It had two additional parts that relate to more like basic principles. So the principle of equality, the fact that it's based on the dignity of persons with disabilities, etc., and the establishment of a special commission for equality for persons with disabilities. So this entity that people can file complaints to. The most extensive legal formal acknowledgement in the rights of persons with disability, as you can see in that act, this Equal Rights Act that I mentioned, is with regard to accessibility. So this has been the right that has gained the most support and the most acknowledgement, both in legislative amendments and in case law. One of the important milestones was a precedential case from 1996, where the Israeli Supreme Court held that a school should be made accessible to a student in a wheelchair beyond the formal language of the relevant legislation, which only required one floor of the school to be accessible. And in following cases, the court didn't really give a formal ruling. It more kind of validated settlements between the parties. But it started to be clear that the court is pushing for a broader understanding of what accessibility means. So for instance, with regard to accessibility to voting places. So you can see maybe if you can start seeing the relationship with the distinction between civil rights and social rights. So voting, the right to vote, it's one of the hallmarks of the civil rights. So here the court was very, very much pushing toward an understanding of accessibility that means persons with disabilities must have access to voting places. This is their basic right. So interestingly, another area that gained a lot of support over the years was education. So education is actually a social right. It requires something positive from the government to do. But thanks to parents' activism in this respect, that a lot of public battles that they initiated, that led to a lot of advancements in this area as well. So actually, even before the Equal Rights Act that I mentioned from 1998, a decade before that, there was the Special Education Act. It was legislated, and that started this process. It established a right to special education, and then that law, so that was a big milestone, but still the language was not very clear. It was pretty vague. So it wasn't clear if by a right to special education we mean special education in separate institutions, or we mean special education as integrated as inside the general school system. And so, again, many years of case law, the Supreme Court didn't really give a decision on this question, and only in the last decade, in the 2000s, the court agreed to interpret the right to special education as prioritizing integration in the general education system over separate systems, and alongside a special budget that will be allocated to allow accommodating special needs of students. This was the Yated case. It was very very known and gained a lot of publicity. And later on, this case led to an amendment to the Special Education Act as well, adding this chapter that relates specifically to integration. So you can see a lot of positive steps, right? We can see with regard to accessibility and with regard to education, a lot of advancements in the last couple of decades. But at the same time, we have other rights that do not gain the same level of support. So we have one very important example is the right to employment. So why is it interesting? Because, as I mentioned at the beginning, this right was actually established in the original Equal Rights Act. So two rights that were very formally acknowledged in that law were accessibility and employment. But this is kind of the classic example of a gap between the law in the books and the law in action. So sometimes when we try to analyze legal systems, we use this approach that examines whether kind of like the gap between what we see in legislation and in case law and what happens on the ground in real life. So this right is of persons with disabilities is a good example for that, because it was recognized in the formal legal document in this Equal Rights Act, but on the ground there was a different approach. So first of all, we could see that the court usually deals more with the question of termination rather than hiring, the hiring process of persons with disabilities. And it seemed that even in the few cases that that the court was dealing with these issues, it didn't really develop an adequate framework to discuss the meaning of what does it mean to hire a person with disabilities. So what kind of adjustments is it reasonable to ask an employer to make, and what is unreasonable? And it seems that the court is kind of taking the stand of more towards eligibility. So either a person is eligible for a certain position or they're not eligible. And it has a harder time with kind of pushing towards accommodating the needs of the special needs of persons with disability. So that kind of makes us think that despite all of these advancements that we have, still the court is quite consumed with this approach of there's an inherent difference between persons with disabilities and other people. So that's why it tends to prefer ineligibility to an approach of initiating this active examination of what are the accommodations that we need to do. And the last right that I will mention is the worst off of all, and that regards to community housing. So this right is not established in any primary law, save some very marginal provisions. It didn't gain any recognition from the courts in Israel until now. And although it was mentioned in that report of the public committee that I mentioned in 1997, it never went beyond that point. It still awaits some kind of progress in the political process in Israel. And there is actually currently a petition pending before the Israeli Supreme Court that challenges the current policy with regard to community housing. So the current policy gives preference to institutional housing over community housing, and the argument is that it's cheaper, but they're saying that that's not necessarily true. In the petition, it's one NGO that represents persons with disabilities in Israel. And they're saying that it's not necessarily true, that actually community housing can even be cheaper than institutional housing. So they're trying to challenge this this idea, and we'll have to see how it goes. So I'll try to make sense a little bit of this gap that we've seen. So as you see, we have rights such as accessibility, mostly, that gain a lot of advancement and protection and recognition in the Israeli legal system. And the right to accessibility, and especially accessibility to public places and voting rights, voting places, it seems like a very basic civil right. So some argue that this is the reason why it gains so much recognition, because it's easier for us to recognize the civil rights, the negative rights, as I explained in the beginning, and other social rights, and the hallmark of social rights is the right to community housing, which requires, at least that's the frequent argument, that it requires a lot of money, a lot of budget allocated to that, so that doesn't gain the same status. And in Israel in general, that right is not, in other respects as well, not only with regard to persons with disability, the right to housing, its status is very shaky. So that could be an explanation, but we do have this right to education that is acknowledged and does get more recognition. So another option that we have to kind of make sense of this gap relates to the public perception of disability, and I kind of touched on that before with regard to employment rights. So what do I mean by that? I mean there is a tension between viewing disability as an inherent difference and viewing it more as a social construction, as something like gender that's very influenced by the way society sees people. And viewing disability as this kind of like engraved inferiority or this very inherent difference may lead to this lesser inclination to make the proper accommodation, to allow people to be really integrated into society in all respects. So that's something that we can see with regard to employment rights, for example. So maybe we won't really allow termination based on disability, because that's something that we'll feel bad about. But if there's someone with disability that's applying for a job, and we'll think, oh no, that job is not does not fit someone that has a disability, so we won't really have this tendency to try to make the accommodations to make this job fit that person. Because we view it as this inherent difference that there's nothing to do about it. So that's another argument that I think it resonates with me. I think that there's a lot of sense in that it relates a lot to the social perception of what disability means. And you can see it in other rights that I didn't mention, like, for example, the right to marriage and the right to family that are always very... They raise a lot of tension, and it's really difficult for people to talk about it with regard to persons with disability. And again, that relates to this perception of inherent difference rather than a social construction. But I think there is reason to be hopeful, because we do see these advancements in the last few decades with regard to accessibility, which didn't exist before. So it's possible that to some respect, to some extent, the social perception is changing. So we're making all this effort to make public places and private places as well accessible to persons with disabilities. So maybe it will start having an impact in other aspects. So just to sum up, so it seems that despite this big progress that Israel has made in the last few decades with regard to the rights of persons with disabilities, there's still a long way to go, especially with regard to some of the rights that I mentioned. And I mean there's a long way to go not only in the formal legal recognition of rights of persons with disabilities, but mostly with regard to the social perception. And I think education has a big part there. It's something that if we want to change the way we perceive disability in Israeli society, we need to affect the future generations to see it differently, and hopefully have a more accepting, more accommodating approach. Okay. So thank you so much for listening, and I would love to hear any questions you might have. Okay, yeah.
Let me know if I'm wrong, but it sounds like Israel is taking its own pathway in developing their own laws and stuff like that, and not really looking toward what the U.S. has been doing with the areas with the building tax. Did you drive that right?
So, I mean, I think the general kind of like the awareness of the rights to of persons with disability, the general kind of like this movement towards fighting for these rights, for using law as an instrument to fight for these rights, is definitely affected by the U.S. The fact that there's more awareness of persons with disabilities to the fact that they have rights is definitely affected. I think in the way that it progresses, it's very affected by the political process in Israel. A lot of budgetary constraints, and as I said, I think it's also driven by a social perception. I'm not sure if it's different in the U.S., I'm less familiar with the situation here, but I think the movement itself is definitely affected, and we always look to the U.S. with our social with our legal advancements, and well, in some respects, not advancements as well. So, yeah.
One more good question.
So yeah, as I said, I'm not very familiar with what's going on in the American. So I don't really know. I know that we have. I know about Europe a little bit. That there are issues that, for example, with regard to the right to family and the right to marriage, that are advancing in more positive direction. That are not nearly as advanced. In Israel yet, so but I'm not sure about the U.S. actually. I feel like the accessibility issue, just from like spending the last year and a half here, I feel like the accessibility issue is much more advanced here. So we still have a long way to go in that respect as well in Israel.
Well, thanks so much. We have to move on.
Thank you. Yeah.
Next presenter is first Christina Pappas. Okay, sorry.
Can you hear me all right?
Great. And where's your clicker here?
Great. Thank you. My name is Christina Pappas. I work at Benetech, which is a nonprofit here in Palo Alto. Our founder likes to call it the only deliberately nonprofit tech company in Silicon Valley. And we do technology that is not, we're solving a problem that the mainstream market is not going to solve because there's not money in it, for example. We work in literacy, we work in human rights, and we work in the environment. So I am the International Program Manager for the Literacy Program, and our flagship product is called Bookshare, which I'll talk more about. I also wanted to say that I have a lot of pictures in my slides because I don't like text in slides, so for people who need a description, I want you to know that the images are purely decorative, and any information contained in them I'm going to be talking about. So I'm not going to interrupt the flow of the conversation to describe every image. So I want to start with a story. This is Dipendra. He is a Bookshare member in India. And he lost his sight when he was 8 years old to disease. He had been a good student, but when he lost his sight, he also lost his motivation and his inspiration and his confidence that he could continue to do well. But he was very lucky because he had a teacher who challenged him to work hard and study hard and do the best he could. And he was lucky to have a supportive family and network around him of people that could help read the materials to him and help him succeed in school. He finished school at the top of his class. He was number 11 in the state. And he went to college where he studied music. Fast forward to the end of his college career, he was finishing up his thesis, and he had a reader who helped him do the research and read the books, and the reader missed a critical appointment right at the end of his time, and he had a stack of books and some research to complete, and he missed the deadline, and he had to withdraw from the program. There are millions of people like Dipendra in the world. The World Health Organization estimates that 285 million people have visual impairment, and 90% of them are in the developing world. In addition, we estimate that 5 to 15% of the population has dyslexia or other learning disabilities, and yet dyslexia is not very well diagnosed or recognized in most countries. In the best cases, there is an accessible book famine. For example, in New Zealand, the National Library for the Blind had only 6,000 books a couple of years ago. And you think of that in a developed country, and imagine what it must be like in a lot of places in Africa or India or parts of Asia. Oops, sorry. So just to set the agenda, I have a few slides, not too many. I want to give you some background about people with print disabilities and how they read. I want to tell you about Bookshare and talk about some of the challenges and opportunities that are happening in the world of print disabilities, especially internationally. So people may not understand how people with print disabilities can read, so I want to take a minute to just set that background. In the old days, people read printed books, and a Harry Potter book would be about as high as my waist. So not exactly portable, especially if you like to read. Or they waited for a human-narrated audiobook. And those took months to create, if they even were going to be created. So only a tiny fraction of books are available as narrated audio. Now people use text-to-speech engines on their computers or other devices to read books, and that means that text can be turned instantaneously into audio text. And they can be read on mainstream devices like MP3 players or phones, tablets, and computers. You also have specialized devices, and the one here in the center is a Braille, electronic Braille reader, and that runs about $2,500, and they could run as much as $5,000. So we're part of an international initiative to help develop a less expensive Braille reader that could be used in developing countries. The advantage of a Braille reader is you could carry a whole library with you and all of your books and do some research and not have to lug several suitcases worth of Braille books with you. So what is Bookshare? We are, as I said, an initiative of Benetech. We're the world's largest online library of digital accessible books. And that's a really important distinction because what makes a digital book accessible and what makes it different from something from Audible.com, for example, is that your teacher says read chapter 3 or turn to page 70 and you can find your way around and get to where your peers are getting at the same time that they're getting there. We operate under an American copyright exception that was passed in the 90s called the Chafee Amendment. It allows us to make copies of books accessible for anybody with a print disability who needs it without asking for permission from a publisher. And a print disability is included as visual impairment, a physical disability that affects your ability to hold a book or turn the pages, so cerebral palsy, for example, or a learning disability like dyslexia that severely affects your reading. So, just an overview of some Bookshare statistics. We have about 300,000 members in almost 50 countries, and about half of our international members are in developing countries. People join Bookshare by getting a subscription, an annual subscription, and that allows them to download as many books as they want in that time. We make partnerships with organizations internationally. Because I'm the international program manager and this is international perspective, most of the stats I'm giving are around international. We work with international partners such as Libraries for the Blind or other NGOs that are specialized for serving people with visual impairment or dyslexia. They do outreach to their communities. They can help verify proof of disability, which you need to join Bookshare. And they'll often fund the subscriptions for people who qualify. We have another kind of partner, which are publishers, because the Chafee Amendment is an American law, and it doesn't extend outside the borders of the U.S. So in order for us to be able to serve people internationally, we've made agreements with over 230 different publishers, the Random Houses and Scholastic and Simon & Schuster of the world, the really big guys, as well as lots of little ones. And that they give us permission to distribute our books wherever they have the rights internationally. So the international rights vary, but it means that about 110,000 books out of our 220,000 are available in most countries. And in New Zealand, to go back to the example, 2 years ago they had 66,000 books, and today they have 80,000 with Bookshare, plus the 6,000 that they made available in their own library. Our books are primarily in English, but we have a growing collection in Spanish and some in French. We also do books in Hindi and Tamil, and we have the largest, I believe, accessible online collection of Arabic books, which is sadly only about 110 books. But the other big library that we know of is in Egypt, and you actually have to go to the library and use their equipment and check out a book, and you can't take it out of the library. So it might be accessible if you're there, but it's not really accessible otherwise. So once we've got navigability and books available, everything should be great, except that there are still a lot of challenges out there. And universal challenges are, for example, an image description. If you're reading along in a book and you've got an image in the middle of the page, you can decide, do I want to read this? Does it make sense? Is there information that I need? Maybe come back to it when you reach the end of the paragraph. Someone with a visual impairment, somebody who can't see that image, can't make those decisions. They don't know if it's worth reading. They don't know what it says. Maybe their TTS engine simply gets a clue that it's an image, but no other description of what it is. So some of the other initiatives that Benetech works on, that the literacy program works on, are on making images accessible and developing tools and standards so that we can describe images in books. Similarly, math is a big challenge for a lot of the same reasons. Math is usually presented as an image in a book. So unless you're using math markup language, which we're trying to, advance as it keeps going, there's really no way to access math information in a book either. And in the developing world, the challenges are compounded because when you think about Bookshare being an online library that you download books on your computer, you need stable internet access, and you need electricity that doesn't cut out every 10 minutes or so. You need a device that's affordable. Maybe that's a computer lab in a school. Maybe that's a tablet or a phone, which is making it more and more available. The other challenge is that there aren't TTS engines, text-to-speech engines, for a lot of local languages. So if you want to read a book in English or French, that's good. But if you want to read a book in Swahili, there is no TTS. And even if Bookshare got a book in Swahili, you wouldn't be able to access the information. So in addition to all of these technical challenges, there are some social and political policy challenges. A lot of countries don't have a copyright law like we have in the U.S. If they do have a copyright law, whether or not they have a copyright law, they may not have resources for a national library, even for sighted people, much less specialized formats that people with impairment can access. A lot of countries, as Hilat mentioned, have a stigma, especially for visual impairment or physical disability, or there's just ignorance because many countries don't even know what dyslexia is or understand it or have any support infrastructure for it. And people tend to look, as you said, at the disability and think about the disability and, oh, we've got to deal with a disability, but they don't think about the ability. They don't think these are all the other things this person can do, and their disability does not affect their intellect or capacity for doing other things. So in India, for example, there is a reservation of jobs in civil service for people with disabilities. But you have 16 years of education that you need to complete before you can qualify for those exams. And if you're not getting the support you need at school and you're not able to learn the information you need to be a well-educated person that can compete for the job, it doesn't really do you very much good. So I'm being kind of Eeyore-ish, but there are really exciting opportunities internationally. The biggest one, which kind of leads to the others, is the World Intellectual Property Organization, which passed a treaty in June of last year called the WIPO Treaty for Improved Access for Blind, Visually Impaired, and Other Reading Disabled Persons. And that basically means that once it's ratified, all 220,000 books in Bookshare could be available to any Bookshare member anywhere in the world, and we could start receiving books from people in other countries so that we could all share our books. We wouldn't be duplicating the effort of making accessible books. The second exciting thing is that a lot of countries, both in anticipation and as a reaction to this law, have been aligning their national copyright laws. So in India, for example, they passed a copyright law in 2012 that is very similar to our amendment here in the U.S., and it says if you are making books available for people with print disabilities, you don't have to get the permission of the copyright holder. So there are a few other restrictions about who can do that, and so we've been working with our partners in India to be able to create the infrastructure needed to be able to get more books from India into our collection. It is kind of a slow effort because a lot of publishers in India who publish the books that people really want don't do things electronically. They continually use film and do things the way the U.S. publishing industry did a couple of decades ago. This growing legal and social recognition of dyslexia, and that's also tied to the treaty, which recognized other reading disabled persons. So even though it's not listed in the title of the treaty, it is very much covered in the language of the treaty. So Brazil is also about to align its copyright laws to make sure that dyslexia is covered. And the growth of mobile devices means that it's no longer a stigma to have a special device to read a book. You've got a tablet or a smartphone or something like anybody else has. And it might be more affordable in a place, in a developing country, for example. So remember Dipendra, who I talked about at the beginning. He saw the promise of technology to help people with visual impairment access the information that's locked inside books. And he got really involved in computer technology. Now today he's an Ashoka Fellow, and he is the head of several organizations working for the improvement of people with disabilities. At Bookshare, we really believe that access to knowledge is a basic human right, and it's the foundation of a strong country. Because unless information is made accessible, people who need accommodations are going to miss out on that important information. And our society is going to miss out on the contributions of all of its citizens. Thank you very much. Yes?
I was wondering, so about how much does a subscription fee cost? Because you know, if you're marketing to developing countries and stuff like that, I feel like that could be
interesting. So in the U.S., it's $50 a year, and in developing countries, depending on their economic status, which we use the World Bank indicators, it's either 40% of that price, which is $20 a year, or 20% of the price, which is $10 a year. In India, we actually pay in rupees, and it's about $7.50 a year. Yeah? Are you working on the 3D project? No. Okay. I know there's some students working on the 3D project. Okay.
Covers for cell phones that are they're capsule, so that you can actually use a smartphone if you're blind.
Oh yeah, I think I've seen videos of that. Yeah.
And they come out with a prototype or something like that.
So. Very cool.
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of it. From books I've read, but it's I think that there will be a lot more opportunity for mobile devices to be more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think actually one of the things that goes along with it, in Kenya, for example, we have quite a few members, but the download that people pay by the gig or whatever. So if you're trying to download a lot of books, in addition to the subscription fee, maybe you have to think about whether you can afford the download bandwidth. Any other questions?
One more question. Anybody?
Kartik.
So after the passing of the whitelist reading, so has it already implemented in that all 220,000 books are now available for access? Yes.
No, the treaty needs to be implemented first. So what happens for it to be law is at least 20 countries need to ratify it. And then after that, any country who has ratified it, it will go into effect and they all can start sharing books. The other aspect of it is that the U.S. needs to ratify it in order for Bookshare to start sharing books. So, no. Our government is kind of dysfunctional right now. And so it would have to be passed, be ratified in the U.S. And I think part of the ratification process is aligning the national laws, which this treaty is very similar to the U.S. copyright law. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is not there, but my name is Claude Cranley, and thanks, Dave. It sounds a lot, and so if you shall brought that, I will turn. Okay. I'm from Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, Thailand, and I received a Fulbright Visiting Scholar Award to spend 6 months in the U.S., and I spent my last semester at MIT, where I participated in a class called Principle and Practice of Assistive Technology. The class was actually started in 2011, so the past semester was only the first time that it's run. You probably want to know what was there, right? What happened there is that we had 25 students last semester, but most of them are seniors or juniors, and from computer engineering, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, most of them are from engineering backgrounds. They do have some of other science majors, but very few. Professor will match students with people from the community, like it is what you do here. It's a project-based. The classes are run actually a lot more frequent than it is here. We have 2 lectures each week, but we also have another lab. We have 2-hour labs twice a week. It's a 12-unit course. So, but you know, the unit is not equivalent to it is here. So it's kind of scary, right? 12 units. So you have 2-hour lecture, you have 4 hours of lab, and another 1-hour meeting per week. Well, for that lab, that is the different part, is what this picture that I am showing you here. That is our first lab. It doesn't really mean that all our students were in the wheelchair, but we asked students to roll wheelchairs and travel the whole campus. We give them 2 hours. We actually have assignments out for them. For example, try to engage people and talk to them. You have to drink from one fountain. You need to go to, and use the restroom. Pull books from the library and so on. So they did use the wheelchair in that 2 hours. They came back and said they didn't have enough time. They wanted to go again. So we let them go again, and we didn't wait, but we, you know, we have TA. So the TA waited. Sorry, where is our TA? That's the nice thing about having a TA, right? So the TA waited, and the next day, I asked the TA what happened last night, and said, well, the last group came back at midnight. So I'm not really sure what they did with the wheelchairs, though, but they went in pair. Well, not that one person rode a wheelchair. You have to actually use it yourself. But the other person, it was only there to kind of like a safety feature. If you're going to fall or you're going to hit someone, then you know, it's going to help you in that regard. So it was fun. The following labs would be like using different keyboards or deal with ethical issues or, you know, and so on. So most of the labs are dealing with different devices that you may be using for different kind of things. Hold on, this is too fast. Now, similar things the two classes have are project-based nature. Over there, it's also a 3-student teams project, 3 to 4 students. So we have 8 projects total, and they also work with the community. What I'm going to do now is that I'm going to give you the design and let you guess what kind of thing this is and what it is for. What do you think it is? Of course, it's a wheelchair, right? So Yep.
Driverless wheelchair.
Oh, that's a good idea. I think we should do that.
Yeah.
That is a good idea, really. Wow, let's think about that for next time. No, but it's not.
Put a soda bottle in that funnel and just...
Oh, you can put a soda bottle, but that's not a soda bottle because it will be too challenging to drink that way, right? Well, I'll come, you know, with the limited of time that I have, it's actually a bird watch wheelchair for bird watching. This lady, Baba, she used to bird watch before she was involved in an accident that caused a spinal cord injury. She couldn't move her leg, of course, and she couldn't move her arms really well, so she could only use her chin to maneuver the device here. And she really want to birdwatch again. So what happened here is that you have that apparatus connected to the wheelchair, but the final prototype is not this one. The final prototype, they use the, I'm not sure what it's called, you probably know that, like a tripod that is really, you can move in any angle. It's like a gorilla tripod or something they call it, smaller one. Yeah, oh, is that what it's called? Okay, and so that it could move in any angle. So that the students had to design the equipment with minimal help from others. So what happened here is that she needs help from other people to put the device on her wheelchair, but after that she could do it on her own. She can use it on her own. Well, so that's the bird watching device. Now, what about this one? Kind of hard to see, I'm going to tell you. It's a screen, a prototype of the screen design on the mobile app. On the left side, it says create a new meeting. On the right side, it says sign in to an... I can't even read it. Yeah, existing meeting. What do you think this is for? For the meeting, perhaps? But... for whom? Who is going to benefit from this kind of app? Anyone? Okay. Well, it's kind of tricky though. She's a person with hearing loss, but she needs to take notes during the meeting. So what happened is that she is very, very good at lip reading. So in the meeting, she will first set up like who is sitting where, and then there will be a camera that will give her, that will feed her with the video, and she would read lips from each of the person directly. Otherwise, without that, she wouldn't be able to see the person in the right angle, so she missed most of the conversation. So this is kind of tricky though. Now the last one, I didn't bring everything though, so I'm only picking some. What about this?
Problem or a scheduling problem?
Exactly. You probably saw my slide before, right?
Yeah.
Just kidding. Just kidding. Yeah. This is a mobile app again for a person with early onset Alzheimer. She said that once that she has been diagnosed with Alzheimer, she forgot her executive task, what she needs to do each day. So this app will help her line out what she needs to do that day, and she could check what she has done. And other person can also help her, reminding her of what she needs to do next, and perhaps add or delete some of the tasks too. Number eight, it was like all these fun projects with the communities. But actually, what I'm going to talk to you today, my assignment today is on the international perspective. Like I said, I'm from Bangkok, Thailand. And there at my university, I started the class in assistive technology called Introduction to Assistive Technology in 2007. But before that, we kind of built our first tool to help a person with visual impairment by chance. I'm going to give the details and go into what we do there. The class is actually limited to students with computer science major. So what we do is we only have senior students, because the goal was for students to go through from getting the requirements from the users until making the prototypes or the and even testing the applications before sending off to the users. These are the projects, but I'm going to skip it with time I have. And these are some of the activities that we did. We also are project-based, but we bring students to the communities. Did you notice that they wear uniforms, right? University student, not high school, but they do wear uniforms with pride. So we need that big buzz. I have to say that, right? We need that big buzz because some of the classes we have, in some years we have up to 50 students. We visit like blind schools, deaf schools, and so on. And these are the projects you can see in the your PowerPoint. Some of them are really, really fun. But here are the products that we've built and developed and actually distributed to the communities all over the country. Here are just our main products. Well, the Cultura Daisy is actually what will be very similar nature of Bookshare. It's actually a book in the format called Daisy, Digital Accessible Information Systems. But right now it's going off to another format, which is the EPUB 3. We do that because there were really very little information of books, audio books, available in a what is called the full text format of the audio books. We need to do it automatically. If you come to school, you don't have textbook that is audio book. You need to do it very fast. But in Thailand, we don't have the law that asks the publisher to provide us with the raw materials. So what we have to do is that we have to read the whole book quickly. So we have to come to speed it up. The second one is called CU Speaking Keyboards. Well, the speaking keyboard is actually very simple. For blind students to learn to use computer, they first have to learn to type. In order to do that, you probably have some way to work on it. But what we do is we have to have we use the regular keyboard connected to our own box. Very little box if you have chip, you know, like speech chip and so on. So once you push you press the key, it gives you the sound. But it produces the sound in English and Thai languages. Very cheap, very convenient. You can use anywhere without a computer or anything, so they learn from there. So we chip this, and we produce about 5,000 sets. And lately, the government adopted the ideas and gave us the funds and distributed the device to every school in the country. AAC, you will probably learn this later, is augmentative and alternative communication on the mobile phone. What we do right now, our most latest development that we are working on is to produce what we call the natural language generation, to generate a language without the order of the photos that the user press. Usually you have to know the order, and then it will read out the produce sound from the photo that you picked. But for this, you don't have to know the order. So to help people with learning disabilities, and also with children with autism. The last one is called a Hummigator. I would wanted you to guess, but with no time left, it's the software that help you navigate the computer without using your arm. You hum. We'll go to the right, go to the left, and you have the sub sound and so on, you know. So then you don't have the language barrier, of course, over there. Other things we do, like social activities for the whole, you know, like for the communities around the country. We even do like Java programming class for people with visual disabilities. But actually what I'm going to leave you with is this. What we try to do in Thailand, or what we have to do, is to produce assistive technology devices at low cost that meet the local needs. My question is, why? Why can't I just use what is readily available? For example, book chairs, or even if you're going to use screen readers to read aloud text from your website, why can't I just use that? Any ideas?
Cost.
Exactly, cost. For example, you already mentioned how much each of the device costs. For example, this screen reader, the most common one that you mostly use is called JAWS, which is actually a few hundred dollars here. But when it goes to international communities, yeah, $600 here, it's over $1,000 there. Why? How much is it? $9,900. Okay, thank you. I thought it was. Really scared me even more. Okay, in Thailand it's more than $1,000. Why? Just as much. Said because they don't have the support locally. They have to send their salesperson internationally, so it costs a lot more. But think about other devices. Like the device that you use in the deaf school, it's in a magnitude of $1 million. No one could afford it. So we need to go around the country, meet with communities and say, what do you want to do? What do you want to have? And we build them at low cost in order to make them available there. I leave it here. The first one you already heard about is the language. Although you have screen readers available, but you probably don't have it in your language, and not everyone can speak English. So that is a biggest barrier. If you're going to make your device available, think about it. Would it be, would it support different languages? If you have a platform that do, it will help you a lot more. What else? Culture. Would it play a great role in the difference of the design? It does, but I can't go into detail. So think about it. When you are working on your devices, it will help you market a little more. Actually, not a little more, a lot more. If you think about these issues when you design them. Laws, rules, regulations, everything plays different roles and very much determine the prices and the needs locally. Acceptance, it is different in every place in the world too. Resources that you have in each of the part of the world is very much different. And support. This is not everything. The list goes on and on and on. But then, if you have your device or apps that actually support different languages, different platforms, and other things, it will help you market your products better. And I'll leave you with that. Think about it when you work on yours. And good luck. And you can come to Thailand too. Thank you. That's a really good idea. The problem is that when they learn to use the computer, not the mobile app though, not the mobile phone, the real computer, the big computer, they don't even know how to start with. I mean, for students like fresh, they don't understand what's going on once you turn the computer on. So they have to learn to type first. And that box is not associated with the computer at all. It's only connected to the keyboard. Just a keyboard. So it's only the typing function that will, let them learn. A team of PIs. We have two PIs, Seth Teller and Rob Miller, who are faculty members at EECS. We kind of surveyed the area beforehand, but actually it's probably the other way around. We kind of gave them out assignments to do a lot of things that they could choose from, so that we want to get the feedback from them to see what cannot be done, what can be done easily, and what are the obstacles. So we should report back to the university to see what else should be improved.
Okay, I want to take this opportunity to thank all our speakers today.
Thank you.